Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Chris Jackson. And we're going to talk about an incident which happened almost 7 years ago. But still, I think it's an important thing to talk about.
Getting back in our time machine, go back to it. Yeah, I didn't. You mentioned this, the Atlanta airport outage. And I like, I'm glad I don't fly through there very often.
But a lot of people do. It's the world's busiest airport. So,
I didn't know that either. I knew it was busy. I knew it was pretty darn busy, but even more than Heathrow or Chicago or all those good.
I always thought it was Heathrow. So,
yeah, it might have been.
Shows. But no, apparently it's Atlanta.
Wow.
Which had an outage in 2017 for 11 hours.
That'll mess things up.
Yeah. And I mean, the simplest summary of the situation is that there was an outage with the main power supply, and the backup because of an electrical fire in the tunnel where the cables ran through. Problem with that is that that was the same tunnel where the backup power cables were coming through, and
probably tripped them pretty quick then.
Yeah, absolutely. And firstly, we see this over and over again. Fukushima is another example where, you know, they move half of the emergency cooling infrastructure up out of the tsunami zone and leave the other half in the tsunami zone, noting that you need both halves of the emergency cooling system infrastructure to be functional to do its thing. But no, a lot of allegedly smart people signed off and invested in that half-assed solution, and look what happened. And it's just amazing that we can have standard after standard, we can have thought leader after thought leader, we can have process after process, we can have accreditation after accreditation, but we still do things that are as dumb as having mains and backup power supply cables going through the same tunnel or same access. It's just incredible.
Years ago, somebody was telling me about one of these, I don't remember if it was Amazon or Google or something like that, one of their big server farms. I mean, it's like warehouse full of servers, and an outage there had immediate effect on all kinds of websites and internet traffic and business transactions. I mean, it just was an amazing amount. It's not like a nuclear reactor falling apart yet. Mm-hmm. It had immediate impact on lots and lots of people. So I was talking to one of the guys that manages one of these sites, and he's like, so how do you know, what's your single point failure? He says, well, if a meteor hit the site, all hell would break loose. But then we've got other servers all over the world that could pick up the slack. We have location redundancy. We thought that through. He says, what about power? He says, well, we locate these things where we're at an intersection of two nets on the grid. And so if one net goes out, we still have power for another one. Plus we have backup generators, and you know, I can't imagine how big those are.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, okay, you're thinking through this stuff. And I didn't think to ask him, do you run all these power cables in through the same conduit? You know, the same line into the building. And I imagine if they did it right, they would be on opposite sides of the building, you know, or in different locations and different whole networks all the way through the building. But I have no idea how they did that.
Yeah. And I mean, it's just smart design 101. I mean, and there also comes a point where you don't need to have, you know, if you understand the reliability, systemic reliability of your power supply and everything else, you can relatively easily work out when enough is enough. Yeah. And the chances of certain things happening become so small. For example, there used to be a rule that you had to have a certain amount of engines on aircraft to fly certain routes.
Oh yeah, like over oceans. Yeah, it used to be four engines minimum, and then I think Boeing convinced them that two was good enough.
Right. And then one of the rationale for that was that, you know, when you said we have to have this four engine rule, I think it's ETOPS is the name of the sort of rule that the FAA created for, in this regard. But
that sounds familiar. Yeah.
But they said when you had this four engine rule, aircraft engine reliability was this. Now it is this, which was an order of magnitude improvement plus some. So that then opens up a whole new bunch of routes. So instead of, for example, a two-engine aircraft having to fly a circuitous route around the Pacific Ocean to make sure it's within a certain range, or certain flying distance of an emergency landing site, it could go straight across, which saves fuel, saves time, and, you know, theoretically everyone wins as long as the rationale for that decision is valid. But so there is a point where you go, we don't need redundancy after redundancy, but it's just amazing how often some of the most crippling failures are down to some of the most basic errors. Many spacecraft have impacted, you know, Martian and lunar surfaces at Mach 17 because of basic errors between European Space Agency components, which communicate torque in foot pounds, and NASA's components, which communicate torque in, sorry, other way around, Newton meters and foot pounds, and Deepwater Horizon's another one where some basic design and manufacturing errors were made. It didn't matter that the blowout preventer had, I think, 8 different levels of redundancy.
And they were all common.
But I think that what's interesting now is to look at what happened as a result. I mean, 7 years on, and there's some big deals. I mean, for example, there was people living in the good old US of A love a good lawsuit. So there's lots of suing going on.
Yeah.
And so Georgia Power was, you know, the utility that provides electricity to the airport. And there was, there was lawsuits and negotiated settlements, and Delta's trying to get $40 million out of Georgia Power for the cost of that 11-hour outage. And when you think about it, world's busiest airport, if you have an 11-hour outage, that means planes have to be diverted to other airports, and you have to pay, airlines need to pay for overnight hotels for people who can't fly out, and et cetera. The knock-on effect is huge. But Georgia Power has since agreed to add backup power generators as part of the settlement. And the airport says, for example, that saved nearly $100 million in capital expense. And you go, no, it saved you $100 million in capital expense, but I guarantee you over the next couple of decades, the customers of Georgia Power will be paying for that, because it doesn't just magically come from thin air. Same with, you know, Delta Airline, who want to get $40 million either from the airport or from Georgia Power. I mean, that money will not come out of thin air, and everyone's going to pay for it later on. So it's not this whole, you know, concept of you sue to get the money and all of a sudden this money magically appears. No, it doesn't. It's just it will be found from someone, just not you, and at least not all just you.
It gets distributed through various means to the various customers and people that are paying for the services. So again, I'm glad I don't go through Atlanta. Because if the airport's paying for it, then the airport landing fees have probably gone up over time and to account for that expense. And
exactly. And the question you got to ask yourself is, if the backup power cables were run through a different tunnel, would we now be having $100 million worth of backup power generators? Would we now be having lawsuits where $40 million is sought to be recouped? The answer is probably no. If that outage didn't occur, it's still, and due to having backup power cables run through an additional tunnel or separate tunnel, we almost certainly wouldn't be having this issue. We would just say actually the system worked. And so I think it's a good lesson, is that when you cut corners and you do stupid things, the rectification, at least in this very litigious day and age, is it's almost self-immolation. You might say now we have all these $100 million worth of generators. Well, that's cool. So you can maintain those $100 million generators in the future. You can get it for free, although it's not free because as a customer to Georgia Power, you as the airport will pay increased electricity fees for the foreseeable future to cover those costs. And it's just a messy situation. They had some allegedly smart people done the right thing from the start. We wouldn't be here admiring this train smash.
Well, the original airport, I probably didn't even have electricity. You know, it might have had a couple of beacons or lights on a dirt runway. You know, it was, and when you only have three aircraft total in the airport, that works just fine. You know, and so then they said, oh, well, we got to do passenger service and the postal guys want to land at night. So we got to put in lights. And then, oh, if we pave it, then we can do a bigger aircraft. You know, it's been like many, many products and industries. It's been an evolutionary one little step at a time. And then, oh, that's a problem. We got to fix that. And that's a problem. We got to fix that. You know, if the lights go out, well, we get all the cars out there on the runway. I saw that on a Hollywood movie at one time. And they get their landing lights out there. And, oh, sometimes planes crash, so we got to get a fire department to sit out here all the time. And, you know, it's been very much evolutionary. So you can imagine that this airport grew and grew and grew. And then at one point they said, well, we need backup power because if we lose radar and communications, then our airport's done. You know, we stop. And it's so crowded that there's no way we won't have a major accident, major problem. So we have to put backups on our communications, the minimum backup on this, backup on that. And then somebody said, well, you've got parking garages and hotels and concourses and all these roads and all this stuff. You want backup power? Where am I going to put that? Oh, here's a big hole in the ground. Let's put it in there. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm quite sure the decisions were incremental and what are my current circumstances? How am I going to solve this particular problem? And, you know, we're all do that. You know, vast majority of products, vast majority of systems and factories and so on is it's rare that you do a greenfield build. You start from scratch, scrape the dirt off and rebuild it from scratch. There you can think through all the stuff you need to do. And I bet you there are constraints of time, space, money, all those things that force you to make compromises. And like you said, there's a lot of smart people working on it. Yeah, that's why they're paid the big bucks is to make the appropriate compromises and trade-offs. And we don't always get it right. And I count myself in that.
You can be very philosophical about being to err is to be human. But running backup power cables through the same tunnels, it just goes, it crosses a threshold that goes well and truly beyond that sort of stuff. Someone might say, yeah, but you don't understand how difficult that tunnel was to, you know, additional tunnel would have been and everything else. You go, maybe you're right, but I guarantee you the largely bureaucratic approach that some of these big, I know I see this time and time again, okay, that's going to be too hard. So how do we change the risk assessment to make the current risk okay? That's usually what happens.
Let's get rid of the relays from the tunnel and move those somewhere else. So there's nothing moving, you know, and.
Right. I mean, the other thing is that electrical cable fires are not new. They are part and parcel of having large amounts of volts going through.
Current.
Yeah. It's a thing. So, and of course, in hindsight, there is like there were no videos, there's no fire suppression system, there's none of that, which would be maybe if that second tunnel was way too difficult to build. Well, there's still options. There's still there's still things you can. Fire suppression is a big one.
Yeah, fill it with nitrogen, let it sit.
Sure. But you can have those. It's not a dumb idea, but even just simply having video cameras down there, so with a fire suppression system, exactly.
Well, yeah, I go back to that. It's a combination of evolution, and I remember seeing it was a colleague of mine when I was, you know, just getting started in reliability stuff. And he says, you know, the system, when they first designed it, went from A to B to C to D, and it just went nice and smooth and it worked. And then we decided to add this feature and we added this option. And now we needed to put another machine here or another process, another inspection. We had a problem with this, so we had to do this step. And so this nice straight linear process ended up with exceptions and alternates and squiggles and oh, we want to do a cost cut. So now it goes this way and I'm waving my hand in the air and it becomes this jumbled bureaucratic mess of a process that, like, how in the world did we get here? And the way he explained it was, well, originally we were making something very simple and there is, you can have it any color you want as long as it's black. And that's what we made. And we got good at that. And then somebody said, well, what if we make it a blue one? You know, and it just evolved into this complicated mess. And it was one of these projects where I was trying to figure out, how do we make prototypes faster? And one of the hitches was that the person that was ordering the parts was judged on everything he bought got used, basically. And so there was the design to make it simple was there was like a capacitor value that was, you know, 100 ohms versus 220 ohms. And the designer was holding off to the last possible minute to decide on which one was right for the circuit. And he was running a bunch of simulations and other stuff to figure it out, but he hadn't decided yet. And that held up the process for 2 weeks. And so then I said, well, what if we buy both? And the procurement guys just had his head exploded. We can't do that. We're not going to use those. And that's the waste and everything else. Here's the project manager, this major project that says it's $1 million a day to run this project because of all the people and all the equipment, all the assets and everything else. And if I can get a prototype in 3 days versus a week and a half or 10 days, that saves us, you know, $5 million of time when the engineers could actually be useful. Because once they finish a design, the time between that and when they get their prototype is pretty much wasted time. And then they stay busy doing other stuff, but they have to hold a lot of things before they have the actual prototypes to test it and evaluate it and see what the reality is. And he says, the procurement guy was like, but I don't get that $5 million. And it's one of my favorite lines of my career has been, so do you want me to tell your boss or do you want to have this idea?
I'm going to potentially leap in and defend the blood-sucking procurement guy villain as outlined in this case. But so many companies can sit here and talk about how, like, this project costs $1 million per day. So if we save save 1 day's worth of, you know, faff around or firefighting, then we saved ourselves $1 million plus. Right. Plus some, but a lot, and everyone can acknowledge that around board meetings and nod their heads and everything else. But we often train our procurement guys to behave that way. We actually give them bonuses based on how 5% reduction on spare parts or components or material year in, year out. And so the poor old procurement guy, not sure if this guy you're referring to was a good guy or not, but I've seen scenarios where you have procurement guys who are fundamentally good guys and saying, yeah, I understand exactly what you're saying, and this is going to be great for the company. We'll save so much time. We'll save so much money. It'll be fantastic. I'll lose my Christmas bonus if that happens.
Well, it was, yeah, he was a technician, basically, and he wasn't getting a bonus, and he was a good guy, and he understood it, and he says, but that's the rules. That's what my box says I have to do. And I'm like, okay. We had to go all the way to the general manager of a $1 billion product line to get approval to change the process to streamline this stuff.
Right.
You know, and it was ridiculous, yet it was a process of one step at a time. You know, the original product, it was the electrical engineer went down to Radio Shack and bought the components himself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and went to the stores. You know, we had a small lab storeroom that had all kinds of cool components in it, and they would go walk over there and get them themselves. But when you're making a million a week, well, then you add procurement, then you add this process, then you add this process, and add this process. And yeah, the bureaucracy sometimes can get in the way. Yet it goes back to Atlanta is, yeah, there were constraints. There were trade-offs. There were, and I, you know, would have been great to be a fly on the wall saying, well, where are we going to put this tunnel for the backup power? If it even was brought up, if did anybody even think of that?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the gist of this whole discussion is take a, as you make changes to your system or you make improvements or whatever it is you're calling it, is step back and look at the big picture. And especially when you're doing redundancy stuff, you know, are you adding a single point failure that will just destroy your effort to be redundant? And that's the Atlanta story.
Right.
It applies in bureaucracy too.
Right. The sheer fact there is backup power supply means they at least thought of the importance of it. You know, it's not like, do we need backup power supply? Yes. Okay, let's do it. It's not like the whole idea of redundancy was lost.
Right.
They need it there, but you know, I'll bet a lot of money that was just, it ended up being a, we need redundancy to say, so we can say we have redundancy at great expense.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a lesson learned that I hope that we all can remember, because it is hard to step back from the immediate challenges you have and say, well, what's the whole system look like here? And what do I need to really do to make this work? That is more difficult. And there's lots of pressures not to. So that's the hard part. So if you're sitting and listening to this story and unfortunately sitting in Atlanta waiting for your flight that's been delayed or canceled due to a power outage, you know, what's on your mind? How do you approach this dealing with adding redundancy or not, or single point failure identification, or all the various iterations of this? How do you deal with a complex system? Let us know. Head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And Chris and I and the other hosts of the show are available through LinkedIn and our about pages. So plenty of ways for you to get in touch with us. So Chris, you got any flights booked through Atlanta recently or coming up?
Not the foreseeable future, but I do know there's $100 million worth of backup power generators that have just magically materialized for free. So
yeah, cool. Yeah,
I'm sure the food at the airport's just as cheap as it was before then.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, maybe that's how they make it up. Anyway, thanks so much, Chris, for bringing this one up. I had no idea Atlanta was out, and I'm glad I didn't know, because back then I was flying a lot. So good for me. All right, cool. All right, thanks, Chris. We'll talk to you soon.
Always a pleasure, Fred.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.